welcome to the Hear It podcast. I'm your host, Rebecca Roberts, and each week we're going to be speaking to different guests about their take on how to engage a youth audience. I really hope you like it. Hello and welcome to episode 13 of the Hear It podcast. Now this week we've got Guy and Mark joining us from 20,000 Leagues, and we're still talking about technology and the student experience, but we're looking at those interactions you have before students are even kind of aware of who you even are and how you can kind of improve those from the student perspective. Here's what they had to say. So hi Mark and Guy, thanks ever so much for coming on the Hear It podcast today.
Hi.
For those of you who don't know Mark and Guy, do you want to tell us a bit about yourselves and how you ended up landing at 20,000 Leagues and what it is you do there?
I would say we have a really good working relationship, I think. So I come at things more from kind of like the social side. And I think it would be fair to say Guy has a much better technical understanding than I do. But essentially, we're a hybrid business of marketing and technology. One of the gaps in the higher education market is that for most institutions, the responsibility for communicating with and recruiting students, there are loads of moving parts. What we do is we focus on the part that gets the most attention from your prospects, which is your website, and is also the thing that generates the most value at this point in time. So what we offer is we offer media buying, but we also offer some very sophisticated tools that assists the whole decision journey. And we also work on the integration of that as well.
Like our focus solution based kind of technology. Initially, this kind of like spawned from sort of bespoke solutions, but from working very closely with our clients and kind of like listening to kind of like the issues that they were encountering day to day, you know, we've managed to kind of see kind of like running trends which have been occurring over the past quite a few years now. And it's essentially kind of what spawned our primary platform called Qs.ai, which is a kind of a system based around kind of like nurturing a prospective student to the point of application prior to them even being on your CRM radar, so to speak. Coming at it from very much like a student first kind of point of view, where we don't want to create anything which will annoy students or not be kind of like relevant to actually where they are in their decision-making process. We are super, super mindful of that whole kind of ongoing conversation, which is kind of like happening between the student and the university, making sure the university isn't talking at the student kind of too much, and it's very much kind of a two-way kind of dialogue which is going on.
We're talking about like technology and the student experience, but that experience a student can have of an institution can start like so much earlier than actually, you know, applying or coming to an open day or like signing their details across to an institution, can't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, go back even further than that and say that what I'd want to emphasize is that we don't see, and I don't think people should see, technology as something that's either universal, good, or inevitable. And I think these points too often get ignored when we're just focused on a solution to something. And, you know, it's I think particularly in the context of higher education as well, you know, if we're online and if our families are online and our friends are online, it can very much feel that mode of interaction is universal. When in fact it costs hundreds of pounds, you know, to have broadband access, to have a laptop, to have a mobile phone, to have a subscription to a mobile phone service, that's all very expensive, and there isn't equity of access there. So one thing I think that we always have in the back of our minds when we're thinking about what essentially is technologically driven processes that we work in is that actually technology isn't necessarily a leveler within society, but it's a reflection of structures that already exist. So something being on the website is an answer, but we always like to check with our clients that it isn't the only answer, because if someone might not be able to access that website or they find it hard to access, I think there's a question there. And then the next step is where we come in, and that's where information does exist. It might not be obvious where that is or what the next step to take is, and that's what our technology can help with.
We're dealing with such a wide cohort here. You know, there's so many different use cases and personas that you kind of have to cater for. We've got data on people who have used university course pages but looking for information, you know, over 2 years before they're even old enough to kind of make an application to study. So in one case, you have like these like super, super early interactions. But then, of course, there's also people who apply really late and over a very short period of time. Then, of course, you know, we've also seen some really interesting data as well on, you know, mature students who, in kind of like the recent climate, have had to, well, decided to shift their focus, you know, back to maybe return to education or going to kind of like study a degree. Their early interactions being negative ones with that course page content, because the content is so useful and it's so geared around one particular type of applicant that it's actually alienated them to the point where they've fed back via like our micro surveys that we run via Q's.ai, that they're put off by the course. So like when you're dealing with such like a wide range of users, it's really important that even before they become known to you, they're seeing the right message which like resonates to them.
I think one of the things that we picked up on at the moment is there's a real opportunity in the market to rebrand the people who often get termed mature students. And I think we think there's an opportunity there for people who want to take a first degree, but who don't necessarily or are concerned about spending a lot of time with students who are much younger than themselves, you know, essentially. And it'll be very interesting to see institutions responding to that.
Why do you think, you know, getting that right has been almost a little bit of an afterthought? We've kind of gone down that route of remarketing and throwing a load of ads at people if they dare to even look at our website. Like
what... I think a lot of it is that my experience of this from running student panels and from asking students who have both enrolled at an institution and those who applied but who went on to study elsewhere is it's almost as though the more you dig into where they started on that journey, the further that initial point recedes. It's almost like the faster you run towards it, the further it gets away. You know, the way I think we have come to look at it is essentially to just ask questions. And so we try and ask the right question at the right time, depending on how we observe someone is behaving on site, that when the person wants to come to that information, we already know from observing the journeys of hundreds of thousands of other people who have been in that situation, what the next most logical step for them to take is. Advertising is extremely useful. And I think one of the points that gets missed is that advertising is not actually about providing more choice. It's about simplifying choice. It's about helping people simplify their decisions. You know, the student decision journey does take a long period of time. You know, we know that. We know it takes, people multiple visits to make a decision. If you know that, and you can repeatedly address those same people, you can actually use advertising as far more as a question and answer type method. So you can actually be using it to show contextually relevant messaging to people at the point you know them to be in the decision journey, and then you can observe their responses. All of those opportunities exist. And at the moment, they're very, very much underused, I think, by the sector as a whole.
I mean, we've talked before about the field of dreams, build it and they will come, but it's almost like taking that conversation to where those students are. So you've done some interesting stuff with TikTok, haven't you, recently?
I think there are all sorts of different ways to think about the various ad platforms. We see something like Spotify and TikTok at the moment as being a little bit more like TV advertising in terms of being able to get kind of high visibility, you know, among the UK student market. But equally, that needs to be supported by a whole bunch of other forms as well that are more specific. I think the thing is, you can't do one thing. What we have found, generally speaking, is that it isn't about being, I hesitate to say this, but being too professional. I think, you know, we see from some universities very, very polished videos, which are obviously very, very expensive. And honestly, for the space that I think that most institutions can work in with the budgets that are available, focusing more on authentic content that you can show more frequently is definitely the way to go. The thing that we measure, and the thing that we measure through Q's, is interactions on site. So I think even today you see institutions putting a lot of money into display advertising, and I can almost guarantee that in most cases they are either only looking at clicks, or the conversion in inverted commas that they're looking at is probably fairly arbitrary. And actually what you really want to be looking at is not only the subsequent interaction from that advertising, but also the follow-on interactions from that as well, because that gives you a really good idea of the depth of intent of a particular individual to go through all of those steps from long listing, short listing, attending an open day, ordering a prospectus, applying, you know, making you your, you know, making you a first choice, not adjusting, and then finally going on to enroll. You know, it's a complicated multi-step process that needs to be nurtured the whole way.
Yeah, so how do we get it right? I mean, how do we balance using technology to improve that student conversation, but at the same time make it...
In the early stages of sort of when a prospect is engaging with a university and their websites, to not be too pushy and not require too much, if anything, from that prospect until they have a level of engagement which would justify some level of university influence or kind of like intervention. You know, I think, like, you know, e-commerce is a prime example of this, like really heavy-handed e-commerce. You land on like a product page, and before you can even view the product, you are presented with like an overlay, full screen overlay on mobile, saying to kind of sign up to like the mailing list to get like 10% off. I just don't believe that kind of stuff really works for kind of like higher education, that kind of like forceful, almost like broadcast messaging. I think you've really got to like understand how to respect the prospect within their digital space. And if they show signs of negative interest or like negative kind of sentiment towards your offering, actually respecting that via your on-site content and also via your advertising as well. So when the student says, I don't want this, you know, making sure that there's actually like a way for them to, even if it's temporarily, opt out of being sort of like bombarded by messaging or kind of, you know, forcing them into a student conversation which they don't want to have at that point. You know, I've seen universities do this. I've seen chat logs from this as well. Prospects get really annoyed. That's really not what you want at this kind of point. You know, you want to be respectful of where they are in their decision-making process. And I think technology can fit into that.
I would kind of like to zoom out just to a sort of a wider point. The uptake of this, it's all happened so quickly. We're going from a situation where technology is useful and optional to a time when it's essential and enforced. And by that, I mean, I'm wary of a situation where you can almost see you needing to have a mobile phone attached to a credit card, attached to some sort of digital ID, in order to access some kind of services. And I think it's when it becomes an assumption that it's a freedom that everyone has, then that's no longer a freedom. It's an expectation that then becomes a requirement. You know, I kind of say in that respect that technology, I think it isn't inevitable. It's a human choice. And so I think we have to have that in the back of our minds whenever we engage in any discussion about technology's place in the education sector. Because our value is very much that education is a universal human right. And if you believe that, then the question of technology and inclusivity has to be considered. Because from our point of view, the university is first and foremost a place of social interaction, possibly above anything else. And it's that intangible quality, I would say, to that that gives higher education its inestimable value. So university should never be digital first. It can be a supporting thing, and it's a very, very powerful tool, but I would certainly never put that to the forefront of how we're thinking about learning and interaction and community. You know, anything digital is through a window. It's inevitably limited. And I think it's just very important to maintain that perspective on things.
Are there any brands or organisations in particular that you think do a really good job, like when engaging with children and young people?
Yeah, I've got one, which is potentially kind of like lesser known. The company owns it. They're massive. They're called Chiranga, a company which have risen to quite a lot of success over the past few years by taking kind of like a music curriculum online and facilitating teaching music to kind of like primary and secondary school students or pupils via kind of like gamification, interactive tools. But the thing I want to kind of like zoom in on is kind of like an offshoot to Chiranga, which is called VIP Studio Session. And this is aimed, I believe, more at around kind of like GCSE level. They focus on kids who want to start making music, want to start producing music, whether they're a musician or aspiring music producer or DJ or whatever, who potentially wouldn't actually take traditional kind of like GCSE music. What they have done is they have kind of created a... kind of like a distilled digital audio workstation, which is like the main piece of software that you would use to write and produce music, and they've shifted that onto the cloud. Granting that access to kind of at least be able to do kind of like the basics in the cloud, it's kind of is one aspect of it. But kind of like the main thing that they do to kind of increase engagement around the music curriculum is reframing the curriculum, the lessons, the content to popular music styles. Whatever they're listening to is informed by ambassadors of the platform, which work day to day with everyone from young offenders to just kids in school, and then feeding that back into the content. So they can learn about music theory via deconstructing a baseline of, you know, like a Stormzy track or something like that, instead of like deconstructing a Mozart piece. And they've managed to really increase engagement with GCSE music in particular. And I find that facilitation absolutely amazing. It's brilliant.
For my part, I'm kind of slightly different, but Teen Vogue. So obviously I'm coming at this from a perspective of, an older white male. So, you know, probably not the best person to ask, but just looking at politics over the past 4 years, that publication is just a standout in terms of doing political reporting and addressing issues that I think are of genuine interest and importance to young people in a way that puts other major publications and other much more major publications to shame. I think the way they kind of address things like Indigenous rights, sexual health, they just speak in a way that I think is authentic and genuine and isn't patronising, is sophisticated.
And are there any podcasts or books that you'd recommend we check out?
If you're interested in content marketing, there is The Definitive Guide to Strategic Content Marketing by Lazar Zamek and Justin Kirby. I recommend this for slightly selfish reasons, as I'm featured quite heavily in chapter 10, which...
favourite chapter.
Yeah, talking more generally about content marketing. So it kind of reflects kind of my earlier agency side work, really, and just kind of querying how valuable content marketing actually is to major brands and some of the work that I did around that. If anyone's interested in kind of words or language, a friend of mine, Helen Zaltzman, does a podcast called The Illusionist. Really, really good. Really, really good podcast.
It's a software as a service podcast by Omar Khan. And it's just really good to hear from tech founders how they've managed to kind of like battle against the odds. It's really kind of like reassuring to hear that with success comes failure, and the honesty kind of around that.
This sounds very relevant to our personal experience, Guy.
Yeah.
So, thanks for both coming on today. It's been great chatting to you.
Yeah, pleasure.
Yeah, great. Thank you.
So that's it for episode 13. Thank you for listening. We've got a new topic coming up, which is all about working with young people next. I've got three really awesome and very different guests coming up to share their take on that.